everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Real Conversations About Aging Parents. Today we have a solo podcast, and we're going to dive deep into the decision to leave one's home and enter some sort of independent living, assisted living type senior living community. So before we get started, I just want to take a minute to talk about what I mean when I say senior living environments or communities. I know we've touched on this throughout the podcast, but I want you to think of it in sort of terms of levels. And so independent living is typically the term that we use for somebody who is 55 and up, maybe 65 and up, that wants to live in a community that's designed more oriented towards seniors. So they might have a floor plan that's more conducive to aging, or it might be that the activities are more conducive for that, and there's not going to be a bunch of families there, but really a select, you know, older adults that kind of have a age cutoff. So some can be 55 and up, or 62 and up, or 65 and up. And whatever those cutoffs are, then that community becomes oriented towards that age group. So independent living is basically, think of it like an apartment or maybe even a townhome that is in a group of other apartments and townhomes that are oriented towards that age group. And the costs are going to be typically higher than a regular apartment, unless it's an affordable community, intended to be affordable, and can include things that apartments don't normally include. So some of these packages can include meals, three meals a day, that type of thing. So a little bit different than if you just walked up to a random apartment complex. But anyway, so those are called independent living communities. Now, once somebody needs care from another person, so they need assistance for taking a shower, putting their clothes on, doing things like that, then you're starting to think more moving into what's called an assisted living environment, which is, again, should be a senior-friendly design. But assisted living environments have somebody available, not necessarily 24/7, but somebody that can go in and help that individual with activities of daily living, assisting them with anything they might need day to day. Typically, this means ADL assistance or activities of daily living. So they're going to help sometimes intermittently, usually not 24/7, but intermittent help with dressing, bathing, etc., to keep that person in their environment, but with a little extra help. So that's an assisted living facility. They don't typically have medical staff on standby, but they do have custodial staff or staff that can help with these ADLs. Now, beyond assisted living, now you're looking at the nursing facilities or nursing homes. And that next element there is that now you're needing some medical supervision one way or the other. So maybe vital signs are taken once a day, or maybe somebody's helping with medication management, or if somebody has congestive heart failure, then there's a nurse checking at some interval to make sure that that's staying under control and assessing them. So some sort of professional medical assessment at some interval is needed. And that's when you get into that nursing facility or nursing home levels. Again, we started with independent living and then assisted living environments, and then nursing facility or nursing home type environments. And when we take a step back, there's a lot of different aspects. It's not quite as straightforward as you might think it is. This topic has come up over and over again throughout the podcast episodes. It's a common topic in my clinical practice as I hear patients and their families try to reason through all the different options. But, you know, like we do with a lot of different topics, let's just take a big step back and try to understand what's happening here. 1% of adults over the age of 65 prefer to stay in their home as long as possible or age in place. The other 10% will proactively maybe go into a senior living type community, or like we talked about, those retirement communities that you can start as independent and it takes you all the way through all the stages of care as needed. When we look at the sentiment of why somebody would want to stay in their own home, there's a lot of different reasons. So one, let's think of the most obvious. So it could be they're comfortable there. They have friends, they have neighbors, they have a community. They have lots of reasons that they want to stay in their own home. Their things are there. It's scary to move. It's scary to think about starting over somewhere else. It's very unlikely that there's a premier senior living community just right next door to your house, and you'd have to literally move probably into a different community. So that's the first dynamic you can think of. The second one is, so the first one is kind of the social dynamic and comfort level. And the second one is really a financial dynamic. As we've talked about over and over again, most of these senior living communities, if you're not funded through a mechanism, a state funding, such as some Medicaid, where there's lots of different criteria for you to qualify to live in a nursing facility or custodial facility. Outside of that, you're paying out of pocket. And for the vast majority of people, affordability is just not there. So you're looking at, you know, a starting entry price of probably $4,000 a month, and you can go way up from there, depending on the amenities and the amount of support or presence or absence of a caregiver. And so it's not like somebody's just sitting in their living room and they're 68 thinking, gosh, I really should just go and pay $4,000 a month to go live in a senior living community. That's not how it works. And so the financial constraints can be a part of it too. I mean, especially if their home is paid off or they're in a low rent area, or maybe they're living with somebody else who's covering the bills. And again, you're at a period of life where you're typically on a fixed income. So not only do you have that social dynamic, that comfort dynamic, but then you also have a really heavy financial dynamic. And that's changed even more significantly in the last 5 to 10 years as housing costs have rapidly increased. The affordability of even moving to another home, given the interest rates, is really out of reach for a lot of people. And so we kind of go back into these are factors that keep somebody in their home. And when we think about the decision to move, I'm going to talk about the counter scenario to that, really, which is fairly common, which is when it's basically involuntary. And so you can have someone living in their home being quite successful, and then there's a health event that changes their function or their overall ability to stay safe living in their home. And then the decision is made for them. So they can't return back home safely. And so they'll end up going into, sometimes temporarily, sometimes permanently, into a more supported living setting. So if you're looking at a situation with a couple, a married couple or a partnered couple in some way, and one of the two passes away, this now rapidly increases the likelihood that this person may end up having to move. So there is a particularly unique situation when somebody is widowed or their partner has passed away, and there was a good codependence, if you call it that, that was in place when the two were living and they were helping each other out. Maybe somebody had some physical issues, the other one had some cognitive issues, and there was kind of a balance there. And so they could stay successfully in the home without a lot of problems. The counter to that is when one of them passes away, now you've got a different scenario. So when there's not a second person in the home, the safety issues kind of multiply themselves, right? So if there was a fall or an injury or a medical event and there's nobody else in the home, that's a little bit different safety level situation than if there were two people in the home, both had cell phones, both knew how to call for help, etc. So when you have somebody who's widowed, that's just another dynamic in this idea of when are they going to move? And it can cut a couple of different ways. So if they're widowed, then maybe they want to stay there even more. They've already lost a lot. They don't need to lose their home on top of that, right? And so keeping in mind some of the time frames after somebody loses a partner or a spouse and respecting that does take time, obviously, to go through a loss like that and to grieve and to change and to update your life. And that is also not a great time frame to suddenly say, okay, I think we should all, you know, get on board and get this person over to a senior living community or something like that. But once they've lost that spouse or partner, then not only is there like the emotional side of it, but there also can be a financial side. Maybe that person had an income that doesn't pass over after they pass away, or maybe that person was still working, or you know, any one of those things, or they were taking care of things around the house that now are going to cost extra money. And so there's a new financial dynamic at play that may also factor into when somebody moves over to an assisted living. I'll tell you, in my clinical experience, the most common scenario is usually an elderly female who has lost her spouse several years ago, who was doing pretty well up into her 80s, sometimes even early 90s, kind of functioning on their own. But then some of the health issues start to stack up, or there's multiple hospitalizations or a fall or something like that. And it just kind of tips the family over into having that discussion. Let's take a look about how that discussion is actually made and who are the people that are making that decision. Obviously, you have the person in the middle, right? So the aging parent or the older adult that's having to make this decision. But they do rely heavily when there's healthy family relationships on their kids, sometimes friends, or sometimes watching friends go through this and then or leaning on them as well. But this typically is the kids pushing for the older parent to go into some sort of assisted living or independent living, and then the parent wanting to stay in their home. I don't usually see it the other way around, where the parent is really, really trying to leave their home and the kids are pushing back and saying, no, 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 we really need you to stay there. So the most common dynamic is that the kids have recognized, hey, you know, things aren't trending well here. We're worried about your safety. Sometimes even I want to be proactive, get a plan in place. And then the older adult is going through and coming to terms with what that would mean. In a situation I'm currently aware of, the decision had been made for the patient to actually move to an assisted living facility. And as the family proceeded to try to sell the house, there was a legal issue. There was some sort of issue with ownership or the deed. And the whole plan fell apart because she was going to use the proceeds from selling the house to afford the assisted living facility. And so we had to kind of back up and change the rehab plan because now she's going back home by herself instead of going into an assisted living. And that's going to require a little bit more complex planning and some more safety issues to consider. Things like that also happen as well that kind of come out of nowhere, especially if they've lived in the home for a really long time, or maybe there's been, like I said, a divorce or a death. And some of those legal issues really can kind of crop up at the worst times. Now, when I talk to adults who have gone and toured these facilities and they're thinking about leaving their homes, I want to share with you some of the insights. What do they say that their impression is of these different, say they go to 5 or 6 different assisted livings or senior living type centers. And when they tell me about it, because I always love to ask them, you know, what their impressions were, and they say it's really small. Every one of them will say that it's really, really small. So a lot of these settings are somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 500 to 900 square feet. And if you're getting up close to 1,400, 1,500 square feet, that's a large, very large floor plan or footprint for senior living. And so they might be coming from 2,500 square feet down to 1,500 square feet, maybe even less than that. And to them, it's crazy because they're like, what am I going to do with all my stuff? So the first question is, the first sentiment is, oh my God, it's really small. The second question is, how am I going to take all of my stuff and fit it in this really small area? And typically their brain doesn't immediately go to, oh my God, how am I going to get rid of all this stuff? It's, well, how am I going to take all this stuff and put it here in this apartment or whatever this is. And then the next one is, it's not home. It's not mine. It's not my community. But there are things that are appealing. And so when they're talking about the positive aspects, they say things like, oh boy, it will be nice to not have to keep up with the yard anymore. Oh, it'll be really nice to have a maintenance person on staff to check on things when I need that. Oh, it'll be really nice to have that walk-in shower finally, or having everything on one level. Oh, that'll be very low maintenance for me. Oh, and look, they have a community room and a fitness room. And there's even one here in town that has a really nice professional looking pool as well. And so they can see themselves in a different light, or maybe a different activity level or a different engagement, a different life altogether once they move over there. And so even once they've decided to move, there's still, I think maybe if you haven't seen anybody go through this or experienced it yourself, there's still a lot of grief and loss associated with that move. Leaving that home, in some ways, and I don't mean to be morbid, but it's almost like a pre-dying. Okay, well, my things, my stuff, like I'm going to get rid of all these things and I'm going to make my world a little bit smaller and go fit into a smaller space, right? And when you talk about it, this is a one direction valve, meaning once you're moving into these different settings, you rarely go back. So you don't go into an assisted living and then not like it and then decide to go buy another 2,500 square foot home and then move back in there, right? This is typically sort of that sequential or linear progression that is not going to, you know, take as many left and right turns as you did maybe in your 30s or something like that. And you can see that in their eyes and in the way they talk about it. And some of the times that I've been most emotionally engaged in a conversation with my patient is when they start talking about losing their home. And they say it with some tone of, I know that this is what's best. My daughter, they always say my daughter says this is the best idea for me. My kids really think it's the best for me, and they have my best interests at heart. But oh my God, it's going to be really, really hard to leave. And that is really kind of where that rubber meets the road, especially for cognitively intact older adults. If you have an older adult that is struggling with dementia or something else, they're typically not tracking things enough to really understand that, especially in the advanced forms of dementia. But when you're talking to somebody in their 90s who is very aware of what's happening in the transition and the loss, right, that is another period of loss for them. And especially in that age group, they've already experienced a lot of loss. Their friends, maybe a spouse. I've even had people in their 90s outlive some of their children that lived into their 70s. I mean, you're really talking about some really interesting dynamics once you're up in that age group. And when talking about it from the adult child's perspective of how you would sensitively approach this, I think a lot of it is, like with any good conversational skills, is active listening first, right? So we think about active listening, we think about first being curious, right? So if I'm the adult child talking to my parent or grandparent, then I'm saying, you know, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, I know you really love your home and hey, things are going really well, but do you have some thoughts? Do you have some friends that have maybe gone through this? What do you think would, you know, be the next step if you needed some extra help? And so having an open and curious conversation, I think, is always a healthier place to start than you must or you shall do it this way. A lot of times when I talk to people about these conversations or even become part of these conversations, we want to also think about the role, like what can you maximally do to keep somebody in their home? What does that even look like? And maybe that's even the first conversation. So you go through things like home modifications. You can go through costing out caregiver services if needed. You can go through these different scenarios and be prepared in those ways. Not, oh my God, at the first sign that there's something wrong, we're going to move into an assisted living. Maybe the conversation flows such that you do the most proactive things you can in the home environment to try to keep that person in the home environment. And as you know, I mentioned this a million times already, that I'm very passionate about that. I do think we can do more for older adults to help them stay in their homes and not have to leave and go somewhere they don't necessarily want to go. Now, having worked in some of these settings and then also knowing patients in some of these settings, I have seen older adults thrive in these communities where they reinvent themselves and get a new social group. They pick up playing pickleball and bingo, and you know, they're just a completely engaged and thriving person. And I've also seen it go the other direction, right? And their world becomes smaller, things become more difficult, they're less engaged, they can become more withdrawn. I mentioned my grandfather before on a previous podcast, and that he was really doing poorly at home, had a health event, which was a stroke, and then ended up moving into a nursing facility. And then the last, I think maybe 8 years of his life were the very best years. He was the president of the resident association. He was running card games. He was telling big stories and really honestly had one of the better times of his adult life right there towards the end of it in that type of setting. And then I think about my grandmother who lives with me, and I don't think she would last 24 hours. She's so incredibly private. She is so she's social with her family, but she does not want any strangers in her room or in her business or really even interacting with her. Honestly, I can't even get somebody into the house to help cut her hair. So it's like past her shoulders. But the idea is kind of knowing the parent, knowing the person and understanding them, meeting them where they're at and understanding that that would be a big decision for them. As far as doing a proactive move, and I've seen that some families do this, which is, hey, you're still doing pretty fine in your own home, but we know, hey, it looks, you know, calendar says that you're 92 years old. Why don't we go find a place that you like within your community? And let's talk about some reason that could be a good idea. One of them is just the limitation on the number of high quality senior living environments, right? So if somebody lives in a very specific community and there was a senior living type housing that was just put in, and it's nice and it's appealing to be there, and it also is just as convenient for them to go to the same church or grocery store or community center that they always went to, and that might actually change my mind about some things. Because when those are sold out, or they may have the perfect floor plan but only have, say, 5 units that have that floor plan. And if that comes up, and I've seen this happen before a few times, the family almost, I wouldn't say prematurely, but proactively locks it down, and almost to kind of make that decision to bridge that gap of that decision by scarcity. So there's not a lot of this. This is a one-time thing. Might not ever be here again, blah, blah, blah. And so that might be a reason, or at least a motivating factor, to move before you really have to. The second one is just if you can afford to do and want to avoid the high difficulty and chaos that can ensue when, again, going back to that involuntary move, when there's a health event or a functional decline, and then everybody's scrambling because, you know, the hospital is trying to kick you out, and maybe you go to rehab for a few weeks and they're trying to kick you out, and there really isn't a good place to go. And so kind of having one of those setups already in place where it'd be easy for somebody to bring meals or send a caregiver really can be a proactive way to reduce distress or chaos at that time. We'll talk about the unique situation of cognitive decline. And this one can be really tricky because, especially when the decline is fairly slow, somebody can be physically safe to live in their home. Like they are not falling or having other issues like that. They can get in and out of the shower, but not cognitively safe to live by themselves. And that may mean that they're not managing their medications well. Maybe they're not managing their finances, or maybe they're getting lost a lot, right? And so that might be a more difficult discussion and different set of circumstances when you're trying to protect somebody's physical safety because they're cognitively not able to really live safely in their own environment by themselves. There are some, again, like these bridging services you can do where they're still pretty okay, but then maybe a nurse comes in once a week and helps fill the pill bottle, or maybe there's a caregiver that comes over once a day just to check on them, or a family member. So there are some kind of band-aids that you can put on to extend the life in the home. But if you're looking at somebody eventually moving into a memory care type situation, again, we get back into those beds or those rooms are fairly limited, can be very expensive, difficult to find. And so once you've actually secured one, most people will hang on to that for a long period of time unless there's a big reason to move because of the difficulty with those transitions and the costs and everything. Cognitive decline is just really tough on families, obviously on the person experiencing it, and does have some unique features when considering what kind of senior living environment is going to be the best for them. I don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast before. I did spend a weekend last spring at the Environments for Aging conference, and I got to sit through a couple of days of lectures of new ideas and innovations in senior living. If I was to share with you maybe two or three things to think about, number one is cost. And, you know, you could read the fancy brochures, but you want to make sure that you figure out very quickly. There are highly variable investment levels, and it can become sort of one of those you get what you pay for type situations. And if you can't independently and privately afford, again, starting around at a minimum, maybe $3,000 a month, and that's for a very small double room shared with somebody else. And then you want to go better than that, you're looking at $4,000 a month, and then all the way, again, sky is probably the limit on that. If you're not in a situation to do that privately, then the only other alternative would be basically qualifying for Medicaid, not just financially, but physically, that you need oversight, you know, healthcare support, those types of things, and then going into a nursing home. Again, cost is, kind of breaks down into those two areas. There really is, unfortunately, not a lot in between. So if you have somebody that has a pension or a savings account that puts them above the Medicaid level, but not quite enough money to go into a good assisted living or a senior living environment, that's where a lot of Americans are. And that is a very difficult position to be in. And I don't have a lot to offer other than those end up being really the options. And then so for that age group and that income group, you definitely want to optimize aging in place as much as possible. It's better for them. And it's also more financially feasible for them. But anyway, so if I'm still in a position to pick a senior living environment for somebody I care about, the first thing I'm going to become aware of is cost. The second thing I'm going to become aware of is just the overall amenities of the facility. How is it staffed? How much easier does it make their life? Does it enrich their lives? Is it one, is it going to make them safer? and more comfortable, but two, are they actually going to have some enrichment? So I've seen some senior living communities that have lecturers that come once a week, or they have special book clubs or new skills or even classes, things like that. Is the community itself oriented towards thriving, or is it a community that just stood up because senior housing is in demand and it's really just an apartment complex that's branded or marketed to seniors, but really, truly, there's nothing there? So that's the second thing I would think about. The next one I would think about is location, and that's convenience to things that are important to that person, and then convenience to anybody helping take care of them or visiting them. I had a patient recently that selected a senior living environment that was in her own community, even though the daughters were pushing for her to move one, you know, on their side of town, that type of thing. And ultimately, that was the compromise. They wanted her to move into the senior living community, but they conceded that it would be on her side of the city and not their side of the city. And so that was the compromise. And she seems to be very happy with that so far and doing well overall. As far as her specific feedback, I know something that really was important to her was baking and hosting, because she's got a huge family. And one of her complaints about the apartment is it's just so small. She hasn't been able to do that as much. However, her specific community does have a community room that can be rented and booked. And so that's been one of her ways of compromising, you know, things that she knows that are really important to her. But on the other side of this, finding ways, kind of creative ways to still meet some of those activities and be present that way. So again, so if somebody is going to this community and they like baking and the room isn't really set up that way, then do they have other amenities that are going to help them meet, you know, whatever's important to them in their quality of life? Okay, everyone, thank you so much for bearing with my voice today. It's been a little choppy. I know the podcast is a little choppy. I apologize for that, but hopefully it was helpful for you. Please do leave me a review and share the podcast if possible, and I will catch up with you next week. Thank you so much.
Hey, everyone, it's Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to take just a moment to review the disclaimer. This podcast is for informational and occasional entertainment purposes only. Nothing discussed here is formal medical, legal, or financial advice. By listening to the podcast, we are not creating a patient-doctor relationship between you and myself or any of the guests. Really, it's just me and a possible guest or two, sometimes three, sitting around talking about difficult topics related to aging parents. If you have or suspect that you might have a medical problem or condition, you should seek advice from a licensed medical professional. If you have any questions or concerns, please read the full disclaimer in the show notes or contact me directly. Thank you again for joining us today. I can't wait to see you next week. Have a good day.